Okay, if we could grab a seat. If you would open your Bibles to Acts chapter 14. Acts chapter 14. We're continuing our study of the book of Acts that records the expansion, the birth and the expansion of the early church after the death and resurrection of Jesus. We saw weeks ago that it began, the church was born in Jerusalem, and grew rapidly and expanded to the city of Antioch, and then from there continued to grow. And we find ourselves today in the middle of the first missionary journey of Paul and Barnabas. And we're going to have to see three missionary journeys, but this is the first. And today we're going to learn about worship. We're going to learn that everybody is going to worship someone or something. Everybody in our neighborhoods, everybody in this room, every person you know believes and trusts, worships something or someone, even if it's only themselves. Bob Dylan, the great rock guy, folk singer, said, "You gotta serve somebody," one of his more famous songs. I won't sing it, but I'll give you the lyrics of the first verse. But you're gonna have to serve somebody. Yes, indeed, you're gonna have to serve somebody. Well, it may be the devil or it may be the Lord, but you're going to have to serve somebody. John Lennon was from a well-known group. Who was it? Beatles, yeah, okay. We have to know not only our biblical history, but our rock history. It's important, okay? John Lennon, when that song came out by Dylan, responded very quickly with a song titled Serve Yourself. So Dylan said, you got to serve somebody. John Lennon said, serve yourself. His point was well made. But you're going to serve, if it's not somebody, you're going to serve yourself. And we're going to learn about that sort of worship, and we're going to see this in Acts 14. I just love playing with these things, so I just want to see, want you to see where we're going to go in the next couple of minutes. Paul, way over here is Antioch. We learned last week, Reed told us there's, I think he said 13 or 14 Antiochs in Asia Minor. It was a very popular name for a city. Paul started here in Antioch. Jerusalem is just off the map down here on my bottom right. And he's gone all the way, and we find ourselves today where Paul and Barnabas are going from Antioch of Pisidia down to Iconium. That's about 100 miles, that walk there. And then from Iconium to Lystra, which is about 20 miles, and Lystra to Derbe is about 60 miles. It doesn't look quite the same, but anyway, and then they're going to retrace their steps. So that's where we're going to go. Acts chapter 14, verses 1 through 7. Now at Iconium, they entered into the Jewish synagogue and spoke in such a way that a great number of both Jews and Greeks believed. But the unbelieving Jews stirred up the Gentiles and poisoned their minds against the brothers. So they remained for a long time, speaking boldly for the Lord, who bore witness to the word of his grace, granting signs and wonders to be done by their hands. But the people of the city were divided. Some sided with the Jews and some with the apostles. When an attempt was made by both Gentiles and Jews with their rulers to mistreat them and to stone them, they learned of it and fled to Lystra and Derbe, cities of Lycaonia, and to the surrounding country, and there they continued to preach the gospel. So they leave Antioch of Pisidia, they go about 100 miles, and they get down to Iconium. And as they usually do, they came to a synagogue. And the reason they always went to a synagogue first, it was a ready entree to preach the gospel and to share the good news of Jesus Christ. And they go there and they begin to teach and to preach. And in the midst of that, we see a familiar pattern that happens over and over again. The city is divided. It's no different than our time. Some believe and some don't believe, but there's a bit of a tension, so much so that their minds are poisoned. I love that phrase. It shows us that there's a battle for each of our minds, but their minds are poisoned to the extent that there's a certain group of them that want to kill Paul and Barnabas. They're going to stone them, so they quickly get out of town and they go to Lystra. Now, in the synagogue, they understood, they spoke the same language, so to speak. But at Lystra, that we're going to look at here this morning, something new happens. And Paul and Barnabas don't start in the synagogue. Maybe there wasn't a synagogue there. They don't quote scriptures. They don't say that you need salvation from sin, that you need forgiveness. They don't say that you were guilty of disobedience to God. They say they start in a whole different way, a completely new approach. They're talking to people who have no background in the Bible or the morality of God. Now, one of the things I found fascinating in my life is it's easier, actually, at times to talk to people who have a background, who understand the categories of sin and guilt. So if you talk to somebody who comes out of a very conservative Christian background or somebody who comes out of a Catholic background, you don't have to convince them of guilt. They're already so guilty they don't know what to do with their life, right? Some of you come from that. What they need is to understand grace. But there's a whole other group of people out there, certainly in our world and certainly here in this town that we're reading about today, who don't know anything about the Bible. They don't know anything about heaven or hell, and they don't feel guilty about anything. And this is the first time in the book of Acts that you see Christians talking to polytheists who have no background in the Bible. And it's really a wonderful illustration for us today of how to speak to our culture. So to honor the reading of God's word, I want to ask you to stand, and we're going to pick up the story in verse 8. Now at Lystra, there was a man sitting who could not use his feet. He was crippled from birth and had never walked. He listened to Paul speaking, and Paul, looking intently at him and seeing that he had faith to be made well, said in a loud voice, "Stand upright on your feet." And he sprang up and began walking. And when the crowd saw what Paul had done, they lifted their voices, saying in Lyconian, "The gods have come down to us in the likeness of men." Barnabas they called Zeus, and Paul Hermes, because he was the chief speaker. And the priest of Zeus, whose temple was at the entrance of the city, brought oxen and garlands to the gates and wanted to offer sacrifices with the crowds. But when the apostles, Barnabas and Paul, heard of it, they tore their garments and rushed out into the crowd, crying, "Men, why are you doing these things? We also are men of like nature with you, and we bring you good news, gospel, that you should turn from these vain things to a living God who made the heaven and the earth and the sea and all that is in them. In past generations, he allowed all the nations to walk in their own ways. Yet he did not leave himself without a witness. For he did good by giving rains from heaven and fruitful seasons, satisfying your hearts with food and gladness." Even with these words, they scarcely restrained the people from offering sacrifice to them. But Jews came from Antioch and Iconium. Having persuaded the crowds, they stoned Paul and dragged him out of the city, supposing that he was dead. But when the disciples gathered about him, he rose up and entered the city, and on the next day went out with Barnabas to Derbe. And when they'd preached the gospel to that city and had made many disciples, they returned to Lystra, and to Iconium, and to Antioch, strengthening the souls of the disciples, encouraging them to continue in the faith, and saying that through many tribulations we must enter the kingdom of God. And when they had appointed elders for them in every church with prayer and fasting, they committed them to the Lord in whom they had believed. Then they passed through Pisidia and came to Pamphylia. And when they'd spoken the word in Perga, they went down to Attalia. And from there they sailed to Antioch, where they'd been commended to the grace of God for the work that they had fulfilled. And when they arrived and gathered the church together, they declared all that God had done with them and how he had opened a door of faith to the Gentiles. And they remained no little time with the disciples. The word of the Lord. Keep your Bibles open as you grab a seat. Let me just point out some of the highlights of this passage, and then we're going to settle down and think about worship and idolatry. First, I want you to notice, and you probably already picked up, the healing of the crippled man. There's an undisputed healing. This man is crippled from birth. It is very public. It is an undeniable miracle. And it's also very similar to a miracle that we saw earlier in Acts chapter 3. Or Peter and John do a similar miracle of healing a man who is crippled just outside the temple. Second, I want you to notice that they say in the Lyconian language, "The gods have come down to us in the likeness of men." Now, this might be one of the first times that Paul and Barnabas are involved in a situation where they don't understand the language. There's not a common language there. And they don't understand what's going on because they don't have the language skills here. And I don't know if you've ever been in a similar situation, have you, where you're around people who don't speak English and you're in the midst of wondering what in the world they're talking about, especially if there's a little tension in the air, it can really be problematic. Some years ago, when Mike and I were to meet in Jerusalem, I spent 3 days in Jordan ahead of time with Charles and Bev Cole. And visited with some Jordanian pastors, and it's wonderful to be with a man who was fluent in Arabic. And I was always had an interpreter, so I'd know what was going on. Well, I went to meet Mike in Jerusalem, and I went to the border crossing with Charles and another pastor, a Jordanian pastor. And it was the first time after 3 days that I was alone. And I want to tell you, it was very intimidating. They took me to a border crossing that was not one of the well-known border crossings. It was out of the way, and they said, we think it'll be okay, which didn't sit well with me. And it was very, very intimidating. The first thing they did after my friends left me is they took my passport, and they had my passport for hours. The border is several miles wide because of all the tensions between Israel and Jordan. And we go across this no man's land in a bus, and we eventually get through the Israel border. And I want to tell you, I did not have the peace of God this whole time. There is no one who's speaking English. And I go to get in a little taxi to meet Mike, who when I saw him, I just wanted to hold him or have him hold me. And I get in this little taxi, and there's four young Palestinian men, mid-20s, very animated, talking very loudly. I have no idea what they're saying, but they're looking at me and pointing at me. And finally, this guy comes right up to me, and he says, "Are you with the Israelis or the Palestinians?" I almost wet myself at that point. I'm just thinking, help me, God, at this point. But it turned out okay. They laughed, and they were very friendly. But boy, it's intimidating to be in a situation where you do not know the language. Well, it appears here that Paul and Barnabas, it takes them a while to figure out what's going on. And when they do, this crowd or this mob, when they finally understand, they absolutely can't believe that they are being sacrificed to as the gods Zeus and Hermes. Now, it turns out that the crowds are probably not so far-fetched in what they're up to. There was a legend in Lystra that was retold by this author, Ovid, in Metamorphosis, and he told the story, the legend, rather, of Zeus and Hermes visiting this particular city many years ago. And there was a legend that went that Zeus and Hermes came and they went to homes for shelter and for food and were turned away from home after home until eventually an elderly couple took them in. We also know from archaeological excavations that there are at least two inscriptions and one altar in Lystra where Zeus and Hermes are tied together as local deities. So the people were kind of ready for this, and they worship in this way, and they call Paul and Barnabas Zeus and Hermes. The Lystrans have witnessed an undeniable miracle, and they say to themselves, could this be the gods? Let's worship them. And the reason they do that is because all of us are made to worship. Third, I want you to know what Paul and Barnabas do. They start tearing their clothes, and this is a typical response, a Jewish response to anybody who would blaspheme the one true God. And you see this several times in the New Testament, in the Gospels, where the Pharisees will rip their clothes when they realize that Jesus is equating himself with God. That's immediately what an observant Jew would do. And they're basically saying, by the ripping of their clothes, don't do that, you know, don't say that. Well, Paul goes on to point them to the goodness of God in creation, and we'll look at that a little bit more in just a couple of minutes in some detail. But this gives us some insight into how Paul would approach people who don't know anything of the Bible, who are not guilty of sin, who don't know the Ten Commandments, who don't have any sort of background. He begins to talk to them about the nature of God. Okay, with that background, now it's time for the sermon, okay? Ready for the sermon? That was just all background. This passage is a great reminder that we are made to worship. We can't help it. Everyone trusts in something or someone. The only question we have to answer is who or what are we worshiping in our lives? Now let me help us look at three options that the Bible presents for worship. Dead God, you God, or living God. Dead God, you God, or living God. Let's start with dead God. We see right off the bat that Paul and Barnabas are upset because the worship is being directed towards a dead God. And we see the ESV says vain things. The NIV translates it as worthless things. I love Bob Gundry's translation. He translates it as ridiculous things. These are vain or worthless or ridiculous idols because they're empty, they're deceptive, and they're dead. Would you look at verse 15? We bring you good news, gospel. It's meant to be a contrast to vain things, worthless things, ridiculous things, or dead things. And the contrast is so real. The ancient world was filled with gods or with idols. The various Greek and Roman gods were represented in every culture. Aphrodite, the goddess of beauty. Eris, the god of war. Artemis, the god of fertility. Hephaestus, the god of craftsmanship. Dionysus, the god of wine or parties or ecstasy or drugs or chaos. In Acts chapter 17 that we'll get to in a few weeks, Paul is in Athens, and probably many of you have visited Athens, and you can still see it today. There's just idols everywhere. They've been preserved through antiquity. And Paul comes to the Athenians, and he says, I see that you're very religious. You even have an idol to, what is it? An unknown god. So they've got all these many, many gods, this polytheistic culture. And he says, you even have an idol to a god that you don't even have a name for him. Well, in this passage, Paul is making his case that these gods are dead, that they promise a lot more than they can deliver. And oftentimes in the Old Testament, you find the prophets mocking idolatry, the dead gods who are empty. And this leads us to our second option, you God. We are made to worship. We can't help it. Our culture, modern Santa Barbara, is made to worship. And everyone you know trusts or believes in something or someone. And again, the only question is to identify what or who we're trusting. Many people today will say, and probably some folks here will say, why do I need God? I don't believe in God. I don't believe in the moral standards of the Bible. Well, let me just suggest that everyone believes in something and trusts in something, even if it's themselves, what I'm going to call you God. Okay, what's an idol? An idol is anything that absorbs our heart and our imagination as an object of trust or adoration. An idol is anything that we might trust in for meaning or purpose in life. Idols do not have to be a religion. They don't have to be a pagan god. They can be very, very different than that, and we're going to see that idols are many times just in our hearts. The prophet Ezekiel, chapter 14, verse 3, says, these men have set up idols, and you'd expect him to say idols down at the local temple or something like that. He says, no, these men have set up idols in their hearts. I personally don't think we're all that different from first century people. We're incurably religious. We will worship something, even if it's ourselves. In Colossians chapter 3, verse 5, Paul says greed, and most of us know what greed is. That's pretty easy to identify. Greed is idolatry. So when money takes a disproportionate or an inordinate place in our life, it becomes a god. A lot of young women bow to the goddess of Aphrodite, with an obsessive concern over body image that tragically results oftentimes in eating disorders and depression. A lot of young men bow to the god of Eris, the god of war, the tough guy god, who worship their own body in a culture that is so body obsessed. After a year and a half absence, I joined Spectrum again, the gym down the street. So you're going to see some big changes around here. I'm down there last week, this is true, and I'm in the locker room, and I'm looking at a guy who has the most incredible six-pack I've ever seen in my life. Just looks unbelievable definition of muscles in his stomach, and I'm kind of staring at this guy's muscle, which is not the greatest thing to do, but We started talking, and he says, I work out 5 days a week for an hour each time just on the stomach. And the rest of him looked incredible, too. But that 5 hours a week just for his stomach. And I thought, I'm preaching idolatry this week. That's idolatry. It's exactly what it is. It's the worship of the self body. And I said to him, I said, you know, I work on my stomach 3 times a day, breakfast, lunch, and dinner. And he didn't laugh at all, which is great proof that if you work out too much, you lose your sense of humor. It's true. A lot of people in our culture worship the god of Dionysus, living for the next good time, the next party, the next chance to get high. Idolatry can be a blind drive for financial success. It can be a worship of your children. I will say it again. It can be a worship of your children. It can be the worship of achievement or academic success or success in a sport. None of these things are bad in and of themselves, but an idol is anything that becomes more important to you than God. And the Bible teaches us from beginning to end that our hearts are idol factories. They just produce idols. So let's come back to the person, maybe here today or maybe your neighbor, who says, I don't have an allegiance to any God. I don't believe in the God thing. I'm not religious. You hear that a lot in our culture, right? I hear it all the time. Probably the biggest idol in our culture is a trust in ourselves above all else. A worship of me, of my opinions, of the autonomous self. What I'm calling today, you God. And from the perspective of the Bible, this type of thinking is so wrong and so misguided. C.S. Lewis in Screwtape Letters at one point says, the man on the street has a dozen incompatible philosophies, and I'm going to add incompatible gods, dancing together in his head. A third option for worship is the living God. We are made to worship. We can't help it. And everyone trusts in something or someone. And again, the only question is who or what will we worship? Notice again what Paul does. If these dead idols are ridiculous or vain or useless, Paul points to the good news of the gospel. He distinguishes the living God from dead idols in verses 15 through 17. And I just want you to see what he does. It's really fascinating in these verses. He doesn't begin, like we mentioned earlier, arguing the category of sin and disobedience. That would not have made any sense to these pagans. It would have been silly. He begins by talking about the creation that they can see. And he talks about the fact that there was a creator. There is a God who made what we see. And then he says that this God has allowed people, the nations, to go their own way. You know, one of the greatest compliments and one of the greatest liabilities that God gives us is personal freedom. Anybody here this morning can thumb their nose at God, and God will allow it. He does not force himself on us. And so he makes that point. But then he goes on to say that this good God who made the heaven and the earth and the sea and all that is in them has not left us. He's not a God who made this and then departed. He hasn't left himself without a witness, but rather in his providence, he's brought rain and fruit and season and food for the gladness of our hearts. In other words, God sustains what he's created. He's involved in the created world. And if ridiculous idols promise more than they can fulfill and then leave you empty, the living God, Paul is saying, gives you more than he requires and satisfies our deepest longings because he cares. Now, I'm almost done. But I want you to notice two ironies in this passage. You've probably already seen them. You guys are smart. But for the few who didn't see them, I have to point them out, okay? Number one, worship is fickle. Worship is capricious. It changes faster than the mood of a two-year-old. You see it right here in this passage. Think about the deep irony of the crowds, these fickle crowds. At one moment, they want to sacrifice and worship to Paul and Barnabas. And in really short order, they stone Paul. They're turned on a dime. And Paul almost loses his life. He's stoned by the mob and left for dead. Now, there's something for us to learn here. We can be so easily swayed, can't we? By the mob. We can be so fickled in our affections, in our commitments, in our worship. I had coffee this week with a new friend from our church, a young married guy, on Thursday morning, and I love doing that, and I didn't know him at all, and he didn't know me, and I met him one Sunday. I said, hey, let's grab coffee and get to know each other. And by the way, when you have coffee with somebody that you don't know in the church or in your neighborhood, just it's really easy. You don't have to be intimidated. Just say, tell me your story. Tell me about your journey. Tell me how you met God, or if you don't know God, just tell me your story. And everybody loves to tell their story. So he told me his story. Grew up in a non-Christian family. Met Christ in high school. Had a strong, growing discipleship relationship with Jesus. And somewhere in college, not local, but out of town, joined a fraternity and just got sucked into the party thing. The abuse of alcohol and drugs and his sexuality. And he said the irony of the whole deal was, he says, I was a believing Christian getting sucked into this. And then after Saturday night and the debauchery that went on there, I'd get up on Sunday morning and go to church to worship God. It was incongruous. It was duplicitous. It was a crazy way to live life. And finally, he realized that his heart was fickled. He wanted a little of that and a little of this. And to his credit, he finally had a moment where he said, I need to figure out what I'm going to really worship, this or that. And his life spiritually took off. I'd like you to think about your life for a minute here. And your week. And what you're going to do this week. Normally I tell you, don't think about what's going on this week. Now I'm going to tell you, think about what's going on this week. Okay? And would you just ponder for a moment in silence your commitments? And are any of your commitments out of alignment, out of whack with your faith and trust in Jesus Christ, with your worship of the one true living God? Would you just think about that for a moment, and then we'll go on.